This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents Midwives by Chris Bojalian. Read for you by Kate Burton.
Midwives. Throughout the long summer before my mother's trial began, and then during those crisp days in the fall when her life was paraded publicly before the county, her character lynched, her wisdom impugned, I overheard much more than my parents realized, and I understood more than they would have liked. Through the register in the floor of my bedroom, I could listen to the discussions my parents would have with my mother's attorney in the den, if the three of them happened to be in the suite off the kitchen my mother used as her office and examining room. I would lie on the bathroom floor above them and listen as their words traveled up to me. And while I never went so far as to lift the receiver of an upstairs telephone when I heard my mother speaking on the kitchen extension, often I stepped silently down the stairs until I could hear every word that she said. And so, by the time the trial began, I believe I could have reconstructed almost exactly what the lawyer, friend, or midwife was saying at the other end of the line. I was always an avid parent watcher, but in those months surrounding the trial, I became especially fanatic. I monitored their fights and noted how the arguments grew nasty fast under pressure. I listened to them apologize, and then I'd wait for the more muffled sounds they would make when they would climb into bed and make love. I caught the gist of their debates with doctors and lawyers. I understood why some witnesses would be more damning than others. I learned to hate people I'd never met and whose faces I'd never seen. The state's medical examiner, the state's attorney, an apparently expert midwife from Washington, D.C. The morning the judge gave the jury its instructions and sent them away to decide my mother's fate, I overheard her attorney explain to my parents what he said was one of the great myths in litigation. You can tell what a jury has decided the moment they re-enter the courtroom after their deliberations by the way they look at the defendant or refuse to look at him. But don't believe it, he told them. It's just a myth. I was 14 years old that fall, however, and it had that ring of truth to it that I heard in many wives and midwives' tales, a core of common sense hardened firm by centuries of observation. Babies come when the moon is full. If the boiled potatoes burn, it'll rain before dark. A bushy caterpillar's a sign of a cold winter. Don't ever sugar till the river runs free. And so, when the jury filed into the courtroom, I watched to see whether they would look at my mother. Sitting beside my father in the first row, sitting directly behind my mother and her attorney as I had every day for 2 weeks, I began to pray to myself, "Please don't look at your shoes. Please don't look at the judge. Don't look down or up or out the window. Please, please, look at me. Look at my mother. Look at us. Look here. Look here. Look here." I'd watched the jurors for days. I'd seen them watch me. I'd counted beards. I'd noted wrinkles. I'd stared beyond reason and courtesy at the way the fellow who had become the foreman had sat with his arms folded across his chest, hiding the hand disfigured years earlier by a chainsaw. He had a thumb, but no fingers. They walked in from the room adjacent and found their seats. One, the elderly woman with white hair and a closet full of absolutely beautiful red flower dresses, looked toward the table behind which the state's attorney and his deputy were sitting. And that was when I broke down. My cries were quiet at first, the sound of a mournful whisper, but they gathered fury fast. I have been told that I howled. And while I am not proud of whatever hysteria I succumbed to that day in the courtroom, I am not ashamed of it either. If anyone should feel shame for whatever occurred that moment in a small courthouse in northeastern Vermont, in my mind, it is the jury. Amidst my sobs and wails, people have said that I pleaded aloud, "Look at us! Oh God, please, please look at us!" And still not one of the jurors would even glance in my mother's or my direction. I used the word vulva as a child, the way some kids said butt or penis. It wasn't a swear exactly, but I knew it had an edge to it that could stop adults cold in their tracks. I remember playing one afternoon at Raleigh McKenna's while her mother had a friend visiting from Montpelier. It was one of those rare summer days in Vermont when the sky is so blue it looks almost neon. Like Mrs. McKenna, her friend worked for the state education department, as the two adults sat around a wrought iron table on the McKenna's brick terrace, a terrace that seemed inappropriately elegant to me even then. I proceeded to tell them about Cynthia Charbonneau's delivery in all the detail I could muster. Mrs. Charbonneau's baby was 9 pounds, 2 ounces, but my mom was able to massage the vagina and stretch the muscles so the perineum didn't tear. Most women who have babies that are around 9 pounds have to have episiotomies, but not Mrs. Charbonneau. Her vulva's fine. I was probably 9 at the time, which meant that the McKennas had lived in Vermont for a little over a year, since they had arrived in our town from a Westchester suburb of New York City on my 8th birthday. I had never been to Westchester, but I had an immediate sense that the McKennas were from a town more mannered than Reddington. The terrace was a dead giveaway. I liked the McKennas, but on some level I suspected that the family wasn't going to last long in our part of Vermont. They might do okay in Burlington, the state's biggest city, but not in a little village like Reddington. I was wrong about that. The McKennas did all right here. And while there were actually parents in town who would not allow their little girls to play at my house, some merely fearing their daughter would wind up at a birth if my mother was unable to find a babysitter, others believing that among the strange herbs and tinctures that were my mother's idea of medical intervention were marijuana, hashish, and hallucinogenic mushrooms, the McKennas didn't seem to mind that my mother was a midwife. By the time I was 14, and my mother was on trial, I had begun to grow tired of shocking adults with my clinical knowledge, but I also understood that words like vulva were less endearing from a 14-year-old than from a younger girl. Moreover, by the time I was 14, the whole idea of a 9-pound, 2-ounce anything pushing its way through the ludicrously small opening between my legs made me queasy. "I just don't see how anything that big will ever get through something that small," I'd insist, after which my father would sometimes remark, shaking his head, "Bad design, isn't it?" If my mother was present, she would invariably contradict him. "It is not. It's a magnificent and beautiful design. It's just perfect." Although my mother would never have taken one of my friends to a birth, just before I turned 8, I began to accompany her to deliveries if a baby decided to arrive when my father was out of town and her stable of sitters was busy on such short notice. My mother believed babies were more likely to arrive when the sky was filled with rain clouds than when it was clear, because the barometric pressure was lower. And so when the clouds began rolling in that evening, while the two of us were eating dinner on our porch, she said that she might see who was available to babysit tonight. My father was on the New York side of Lake Champlain that evening because builders were going to break ground the next day for a new math and science building he had helped to design for a college there. The first infant I saw delivered at home was Emily Joy Pine. EJ, as she would come to be called, was an easy birth, but it didn't look that way to me. When we arrived, Lori Pine was sitting on the side of her bed with a light cotton blanket draped over her shoulders, but the other bedding, blankets and bedspreads and sheets, had been removed and piled in a small mountain on the floor. The mattress was covered with a sheet with the sort of pattern that might have looked appropriate on a big, ugly shower curtain, lots of psychedelic sunflowers and suns. That sheet, I would overhear, had been baked in a brown paper grocery bag for over an hour in the couple's kitchen oven. It may have been tasteless, but it was sterile. When my mother and I arrived, the woman who was her apprentice back then was already there. My mother was nothing if not hygienic, and after she had said hello, she went straight to the Pines' bathroom to wash up. She would probably spend 10 full minutes scrubbing her hands and arms before she would place her palms softly upon a woman's stomach, or pull on a pair of thin rubber gloves and explore a laboring mother's cervix. When she emerged from the bathroom, she asked Lori to lie back so she could see how she was doing. Lori and David's 2 small sons had already been taken up the road to their uncle's house. Lori lay back on the bed, and as she did, her blanket fell away, and I saw she was naked underneath it. Her pregnant belly rose from the bed like a mountain. I stared with such wonder in my eyes that Lori rolled her face toward me and panted what I have since come to believe was the word, condoms. I've never figured out whether the word was meant for me as a piece of advice that I should take to heart, as in, demand that your man always wear a condom so you don't end up trying to push a pickle through a straw, or as a warning against that particular form of contraception. "This is the fault of a condom. There are better forms of birth control out there, and if I'd any sense at all, I'd have used one. Whether Lori Pine really did say the word condoms, or something else, or merely my name when she saw me standing there, my name is Constance, but at a young age, I learned to prefer Connie. I'll never know. I like to believe she said condoms. So many other beliefs shatter when we grow up. I want to keep this one intact. In any case, whatever she said made everyone in the room aware of the fact that I was there, leaning against the wall. "Do you mind if she stays, Lori?" my mother asked, nodding in my direction. "Tell me, honestly." Lori's husband took her hand and stroked it, adding, "She could join the boys at their uncle's, you know." But Lori Pine said she didn't mind having me there at all. And so I stayed, and got to see Lori Pine's labor and E.J. Pine's birth. Labor was about 9.5 hours, and it was, in the opinion of everyone present, a breeze. Everyone but me. I hadn't really seen an adult in pain until then. But my mother was great with Lori, endlessly smiling and reassuring her that she and her baby were well. "Oh my, you're doing fine. No, not fine. Terrific. Your baby will be here by breakfast." And it was. The books say conception occurs when a sperm penetrates a female egg, and they all use that word, penetration. It's as if life begins as a battle. Let's storm the egg. What's wrong with meet, or merge, or just groove together? From the Notebooks of Sybil Danforth, Midwife. When things go wrong in obstetrics, they go wrong fast. They fall off a cliff. One minute, mom and fetus are happily savoring the view from the top, and the next, they're tumbling over the edge and free-falling into the rocks below. I would hear physicians use those sorts of analogies all the time. Their point was always the same. Women should not have their babies at home with my mother. They should have them in hospitals with physicians. In the late 1970s and early 80s, my mother was one of a dozen independent or lay midwives in Vermont who delivered babies at home. Virtually no doctors did. The cost of malpractice insurance for home birth was prohibitive, and most OBGYNs really believed it was safer to bring children from womb to world in a hospital. My mother believed that home birth was safe at least in part because she refused to deliver any high-risk pregnancies at home. And she never hesitated to transfer a laboring mother in her care to the hospital if something was, as she once described the feeling to me, making her heart beat a little faster than she liked. There's no question in my mind that my mother and the medical community disliked each other, but she would never have let their conflicts jeopardize the health of one of her patients. That's a fact. I could begin my mother's story with Charlotte Fugit Bedford's death, but that would mean I'd chosen to open her life with what was for her the beginning of the end. So I won't. Besides, I view this as my story too, and why I believe babies became my calling as well. And I am convinced that our stories began in the early spring of 1980, a full 18 months before my mother would watch her life unravel in a crowded courtroom in northern Vermont, and at least a full month before the Bedfords would even arrive in our state. Here's what I recall. I recall that the mud was a nightmare that year, but the sugaring was amazing. That's often the case. If the mud is bad, the maple will be good, because mud and maple are meteorological cousins of a sort. The kind of weather that turns dirt roads in Vermont into quicksand in March, frigid, snowy winter, followed by a spring with warm days and cold, cold nights, also inspires maple trees to produce sap that is sweet and plentiful and runs like the rivers swollen by melted snow and ice. My mother's and father's families no longer sugared, and so my memories of that March revolve more around mud than maple syrup. The mud was everywhere for 2 weeks in March. The dirt roads became sponges into which automobiles were constantly sinking. Yards became bogs that slowed running dogs to a walk. My mother parked her station wagon just off the paved road at the end of our driveway to ensure that she could get to her patients in a timely fashion. But the sugaring was good, and the syrup crop huge. My best friend Raleigh McKenna had a horse, and although the two of us were never supposed to ride her at the same time, we did often. And that March we rode up to the Brennan's sugar house after school so we could smell the sweet fog that enveloped the place. Of course, there were other reasons for riding into the hills. We also rode there because the roads we took to the sugar house would lead us past the town ball field, where Tom Quartz and his friends would smoke cigarettes. At 12, and fast approaching 13, I would ride or run or walk miles out of my way to watch Tom Quartz, 2 years older than I, and therefore in the 9th grade, smoke cigarettes. He wore turtlenecks all the time, usually black or navy blue, and they always made him look a little dangerous. But his hair was a very light blonde, and his eyes a shade of green that was almost girlish. And that made the aura of delicious delinquency that surrounded him almost poetic. Tom was the first of many sensitive smokers with whom I would fall deeply in love. And while I have never taken up that habit myself, I know well the taste of smoke on my tongue. Tom had a reputation for driving adults wild, although rarely in ways they thought they should or could discipline. He was the sort of wild card who would skip a class trip to the planetarium in St. Johnsbury, but then write an essay on black holes that would astonish the teacher. Initially, my father disliked Tom. I think my father, the sort of orderly architect who would stack his change by size every single night, thought Tom ran a little too wild. My father came from a family of achievers, and although he knew Tom was very smart, he still feared the boy might end up like most of the Quartzes in Reddington, working by day at the messy automotive garage that looked like a rusted-out auto graveyard, while trying to buy Budweiser with food stamps at night. It probably wasn't a bad life if you kept your tetanus shots current, but it wasn't the life my father wanted for his only child. My mother understood why I found Tom cute, but she too had her reservations. "There are probably worse mushrooms in this world than a boy like Tom Quartz," she once warned. "But I still want you to be careful around him. Keep your head." They had both underestimated Tom, as they'd see the next year. He was always there for me when I needed him most. In the mud season of 1980, Raleigh's horse, Witchgrass, was 20 years old, and while her best years were well behind her, she was a good horse for us, patient, undemanding, and slow to accelerate. Raleigh and I planned, as we had the day before, to take turns riding Witchgrass up Gove Hill. When the horse had had a chance to stretch her legs, we would ride together across the street and past the general store to the ball field, stealing a glimpse of Tom Quartz and his vaguely truant friends. We might then continue up to the sugar house. So Raleigh took off on Witchgrass first, and I climbed over the electric fencing into the field by the barn where the horse grazed, and began shoveling the big clumps of horse turds into what Raleigh and I secretly referred to as the shit barrow. Witchgrass wasn't my horse, but I spent so much time riding her that I tried to help with her care. I hadn't been at it long when I heard my mother's station wagon churning up the street toward me. She slowed down when she saw me and rolled down her window. I crossed the street with a McKenna's shovel still in my hands. "Wanda Purington's baby's coming," she said, smiling serenely the way she did whenever one of her mother's labors had commenced. "Is she far along?" I asked. "The contractions sound close. We'll see." "You won't be home for dinner, will you?" "No, sweetheart. You and Daddy are on your own. Do you mind making dinner?"
"No."
But I did, and of course my mother knew it. "I took some chopped meat out of the freezer. Make hamburgers." "Uh-huh." She leaned her head partway out the window. "A kiss, please?" I obeyed, a perfunctory peck on the cheek, and then watched her head off. I wasn't exactly angry with her as much as I was frustrated. I'd have to be home earlier than I'd planned. I always felt a moral obligation of sorts when my mother was gone to be home when my father returned from work. I don't know if the idea was drummed into my head by the situation comedies I watched for hours on our snowy, static-filled television, or if it was a result of my sense of how my friends' mothers behaved. Mothers were supposed to be in the house when fathers came home from wherever they worked. I stalked back to the field and shoveled half-heartedly for a few minutes, knowing there wouldn't be time for me to both take a ride up Gove Hill and find a pretext with the horse to watch Tom Quartz smoke cigarettes. And so I decided to stroll by the ball field alone. Tom was sitting with two older boys when I wandered by. I recognized that one was an O'Gorman and the other was Billy Metcalf. Had Tom been alone, I might have found the courage for a detour to the bleachers, but he wasn't, so I trudged straight ahead to the store. As I was paying for my gum, I heard the bell on the store's front door jingle. The O'Gorman boy and Billy Metcalf were strolling toward the refrigerator case at the back of the store. I expected Tom Quartz to wander in behind them, but he didn't. I assumed this meant he had gone home, but I still held out the dim hope that he was alone at the ball field. But the bleachers were empty. I tried to lose my disappointment in the satisfaction of well-blown bubbles, and marched back to the field I'd been shoveling. I stretched my legs over the electric wire and picked up the shovel. Leaning against the wall of the barn, no more than 20 yards away, was Tom Quartz. He pulled a cigarette from his mouth and started toward me. I stood still, waiting with my heart in my head. When he had gotten so close, I could smell the cigarettes on his breath. He stopped and asked, "They pay you for this?"
"No."
"Then why do you do it?"
"Because Raleigh's my friend."
He nodded. "And 'cause you ride the horse?"
"That too." "Do you ride?"
He shook his head. "No, just snowmobiles and motorcycles." I'd seen Tom ride snowmobiles, often when my father and I would go cross-country skiing. We'd probably pulled off the trail a dozen times for Tom and his older friends and cousins.
"I've never ridden a snowmobile."
"I'll take you if you like. Maybe even this year. We'll get more snow, you know."
"Oh, I know."
He flicked a cigarette toward his feet and ground it deep into the mud. "You have Mrs. Perda for French, right?"
"Right."
"Like her?"
"I do, sure."
He nodded, taking this fact in and turning it over in his mind for meaning. A signal, confirmation perhaps, of my maturity. Then he said something that might have been threatening to me had I not heard three of those words from my mother only a short while before, a coincidence that suggested to me a cosmic rightness. Moreover, his voice was suddenly filled with an unease that mirrored my own. "A kiss before I go, please?" he asked. I stood still before him, and after a second he leaned toward me and pressed his lips against mine. We both opened our mouths a sliver and tasted each other's breath. It was only after our bodies parted that I realized he hadn't put his tongue into my mouth. I was glad, but mostly because I wouldn't have known how to juggle Tom Quartz's tongue with a large piece of bubblegum hiding somewhere in my cheek. It would be a good 8 months before Tom and I would become boyfriend and girlfriend, and a full year and a half before I would find myself crying at night in his arms. Zygote isn't a bad word, but it's far from perfect. On the one hand, I love the word's origin, the Greek word for joining together. That feels right to me, because that's about what has occurred. An egg and a sperm have joined together. On the other hand, I don't like the way the word sounds when you say it out loud. Zygote. It always sounds like it needs an exclamation point. It sounds like a curse from some angry mad scientist. Zygote. The beaker is cracked. Zygote, there's radium all over the lab. From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. My mother was a full-fledged, honest-to-God, no-holds-barred, Liberation News Service peace, love, and tie-dye hippie. This was no small accomplishment, since she grew up in a small village in northern Vermont. Villages like Reddington are buffered from cultural change by high mountains, harsh weather, bad television reception, and low population density, so it probably took a certain amount of attentiveness, research, and spine to find the revolution, or even a decent peasant skirt. The photographs of her taken during the second half of the 1960s show a woman who apparently lived in bell-bottoms and shawls. Those photos reveal a woman with round blue eyes and spiraling dirty blonde hair, characteristics I've inherited, although my hair is flatter by far than hers ever was. She went to Mount Holyoke for 2 years, but decided to drop out, and for a while she was settled in Boston, helping the Black Panthers start a breakfast program for the poor. By the spring she had had enough, not because she had grown tired of the movement, but because she longed for the country, for Vermont. She wanted to go home, and finally she did. By July she had fallen in with a group of self-proclaimed artists in the hills northeast of Montpelier, an assemblage of singers and painters and writers that included an illustrator who would eventually decide to become an architect instead of an album cover designer, my father. My mother became pregnant with me soon after that. My conception postponed forever any discussion of Sybil's returning to college. That's one of the main reasons that my mother became a lay midwife instead of a medically trained nurse midwife, or perhaps even an obstetrician gynecologist. No college degree and, over time, the conclusion that she didn't need one. Of course, she also believed with a passion that in most cases women should have their babies at home. Women, in her mind, labored most efficiently in the environment that made them the most comfortable. Likewise, it was important to greet a baby in a room that was warm and to catch it with hands that were kind. My mother knew home birth wasn't for everyone, but she wanted it to remain a viable option for those who were interested. If she had become a doctor or nurse midwife, the state's Board of Medical Practice would have tried to force her to practice in a hospital. That was how the regulations worked then. That's how they work now. If doctors and nurse midwives deliver babies at home, they do so without malpractice insurance or state sanction. So from my mother's perspective, there was no reason to get any sort of medical degree. She knew what she was doing. Mine was not the first birth at which my mother was present. Mine was the third. In the year and a half between her return from Boston and my arrival in Vermont, two other women in that circle of friends northeast of Montpelier had children. The first of those births, and my mother's baptism to midwifery, was Abigail Joy Wakefield's. The little girl was supposed to have been born in a hospital, but she arrived 2 weeks early. The six adults who were present the night her mother's labor began, including the two people who had become my own parents, feared they were too stoned to try and drive. Consequently, in a reversion to sex roles, the men agreed to run the 3.5 miles up the road to the payphone at the general store, where they could call an ambulance, and the women took the laboring mother upstairs to make her as comfortable as possible. All three men went, including my father. My father insisted that it was a spontaneous decision triggered by the fact that all of the men had dropped acid and simply failed to think the decision through properly. My mother and her female friends always teased him, however, that each guy had been a typical male who had wanted to get as far away from a woman in labor as humanly possible. Fortunately, neither my mother nor Abigail Joy's mother, Alexis Bell Wakefield, were tripping. Initially, my mother and Alexis were joined in the bedroom by Luna Raskin. Unlike the other two women, Luna did have all sorts of synthetic chemicals in her body, and every time Alexis sobbed, "Oh God, it hurts so much," Luna would grab my mother's shirt and wail, "They're killing her! They're killing her!" So my mother threw Luna out of the bedroom and delivered the baby herself. For the next 30 minutes, Alexis would push and rest, all the while my mother kept cheering Alexis on. A little before 1 a.m, my mother nearly fell back off the bed, when all of that pushing suddenly worked, and she was staring down into a baby forehead, baby eyes, a baby nose, and a baby mouth. The baby was pink, and when she opened her eyes and started to howl, my mother heard sirens racing up the hill to the farmhouse, and she knew an ambulance was about to arrive. She was at once relieved and disappointed. She had been scared, no doubt about it, but something about the pressure of the moment had given her a high that made her giddy. When Sybil's friend Donna went into labor a few months later, she asked my mother to be with her in the hospital. I'm not sure when I started using the expression aura surge, or simply the word surge. While I've always understood the biological rationale for the medical establishment's use of the word contraction, based both on Connie's birth and all of the births I've attended, the idea of a surge reflects both the baby's desire for progress and the mother's unbelievable power. Surge may also be more spiritually accurate, especially if it's called an aura surge. From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. As late as the fall of 1981, the autumn of my mother's trial, my father Rand was still wearing sideburns that descended to just below each earlobe. When the testimony was especially damaging to my mother, or when my mother was being cross-examined by the state's attorney, I watched my father pull nervously at the dark hair beside his ears. State's Attorney William Tanner. So you asked Reverend Bedford to bring you a knife?
Sybil Danforth.
Yes.
Both Reverend Bedford and your apprentice recall you requested, quote, the sharpest knife in the house, unquote. Were those your words?
Those might have been my words.
Is the reason you needed the sharpest knife in the house because you don't carry a scalpel?
No, of course I don't. I've never met a midwife who does.
Is that because a midwife is not a surgeon?
Yes.
Do you believe surgeons possess a special expertise that you as a midwife do not?
Good Lord, don't you think so?
Mrs. Danforth.
Yes, surgeons know things I don't. I've never said I was a surgeon.
Is cesarean section a surgical procedure?
Obviously.
Do you think you're qualified to perform this surgery?
In even my worst nightmares, I never imagined I'd have to.
I'll repeat my question. Do you think you're qualified to perform this surgery?
No, and I've never said that I thought I was.
And yet you did, with a kitchen knife, on a living woman you—
I would never endanger the mother to save the fetus.
You didn't endanger the mother, you killed—
Objection!
My mother's lawyer exclaimed.
Perhaps I should have been surprised that by the end of the trial my father had any hair left at all. In photographs taken the following winter, his hair looks as if it has begun to gray, but the sideburns are as prominent as ever. My mother's calling, to her it was never a job, meant that my father was much more involved with me as a child than the fathers of most of my friends were with them. My father and I spent a fair amount of time together driving around northern Vermont in his Jeep. Often, he was chauffeuring Raleigh and me to the bookstore or the toy shop in distant Montpelier. And although my father was unfailingly patient with me, I know the demands of my mother's calling strained their marriage. Their arguments would filter up through the registers in the ceilings of the rooms on the first floor of our house.
"She needs a mother, damn it," my father would snap.
Against all experience, he continued to believe he could use me as a trump card to convince my mother to stay home. It never worked. At the beginning of these fights, my mother always sounded more perplexed and hurt than angry. But underneath that initial sadness in her tone was a stubbornness as unyielding as Vermont granite. She could no sooner stop delivering babies than people could stop having them. But I also believe that my father deserves high marks for simply enduring all that he did. The husbands of most midwives don't put up with their spouses' hours for long, and most of my mother's midwife friends had been divorced at least once. Usually my parents' arguments ended in silence, often because my father was incredulous.
"Wait a minute, didn't the baby arrive at 6 in the evening?
I might hear my father asking. "Yep, Julia, such a pretty girl."
"It's past 9 o'clock. What the hell have you been doing for the last 3 hours?
"Folding baby clothes. You know I love folding baby clothes."
"You were folding baby clothes for 3 hours?
"Oh, for God's sakes, Rand. You know I didn't stay there just to fold baby clothes. I wanted to make sure everyone was okay. It is their first child, you know."
"So how long did you spend?"
30 minutes, Rand. I probably spent 30 minutes actually folding onesies and Julia's tiny little turtlenecks.
"But you did hang around for 3 hours.
"Yes, I did. I made sure Julia was nursing, and Julia's mom was up and around. I made sure the family had plenty of food in the refrigerator, and the neighbors were planning to bring by casseroles for the next few days."
"And you made sure the baby's clothes were folded."
"You bet," my mother might say. And I could see in my mind my father shaking his head in quiet astonishment. A moment later, I would hear him leave the kitchen, where they might have been bickering, and go upstairs alone to their bedroom. Sometimes later, I'd hear them make love as they made up. To this day, I remember the noise their bed made as among the most reassuring sounds I've ever heard. Unfortunately, there were also those fights that would escalate and become ugly, sometimes because my father had been drinking. I never heard my parents slap or hit each other, but powered by bad scotch and exhaustion, they'd say things as wounding as a fist. On those nights my father chose to smother his frustrations with scotch, my parents' fights were like powerful 3 a.m. thunderstorms, loud and scary, but causing little apparent damage. When we'd all have breakfast together the next day, I'd know my parents never stopped loving each other, and one or the other of them was always there for me. Given the amount of time I spent Being transported places by my father, it shouldn't surprise me that my first exposure to the Bedfords was with him. But of course, it was through my mother that our family's fates were linked. Mrs. Bedford was one of my mother's patients and the center of the very public tragedies our two families faced. Mrs. Bedford, Charlotte Fugit Bedford, I would learn later in the newspapers, was from Mobile, Alabama. It's tempting to refer to her as one of the Mobile Fugits, but that would imply a lineage more impressive than the generations of sharecroppers and bootleggers and petty thieves that I know were in fact her ancestry. Her husband, the Reverend Asa Bedford, was from a tiny Alabama town, farther in from the coast, called Blood Brook. I liked the Bedfords very much when I met them. Most people did. They were apocalyptic eccentrics, but she was sweet and he was kind. I know they had followers, and I assume they had friends. When they came to Vermont, the Bedfords lived 30 minutes north of us in Lawson, and Reverend Bedford's small parish was another 20 or 30 minutes north of that in Fallsburg. His church was an easy morning walk to the Canadian border. When the Bedfords arrived in the Green Mountains, convinced that Vermont's rural Northeast Kingdom was ripe for revival, they had one child, a 7-year-old boy they named Jared, but whom Mrs. Bedford always called Fugi, a diminutive of sorts for her own family's name. Fugi was schooled at home by his parents, which meant that my friend Raleigh's mother visited the family periodically as an examiner for the state education department. She recommended her daughter Raleigh as a diligent and responsible babysitter for the boy. It was therefore in the capacity of friend of the babysitter that I first met the Bedfords when my father drove me there late on a Saturday afternoon to keep Raleigh company. Their house was modest and old, and buried in deep wood at the end of a long dirt road. The place was a compact two-story box, its roof's angle wide and gentle, its walls the yellow of daffodils. This Saturday I met the three Bedfords, the cluster of cells that would become Vale, spelled with an E, V-E-I-L, for reasons I imagine only Asa fully understood, did not yet exist, but would be formed very soon. Whatever fears of or enthusiasms for the apocalypse Asa harbored inside him were not usually apparent in his appearance. His face was almost as round as his eyeglasses, and his hair had receded back far on his head. What hair he had, however, was thick and reddish-brown. He looked like the sort of rural businessman I might observe in St. Johnsbury or Montpelier. He was also one of those rare and special adults who is capable of being every bit as silly as children, and Fugi adored him for it. I witnessed the preacher waddling like a duck for Fugi and making up rhymes to teach the boy how to spell certain sounds. I was sent for the rant on the polka dot tant. Around Raleigh and me, he was gentle and serene. I understood on some level that he was considered a little strange by most people, but the Northeast Kingdom had always had its share of cults and communes, and Asa's little church was simply one more essentially harmless example. He had a thick southern accent, which made his sentences always sound like songs to me. Charlotte Bedford was a petite, fragile-looking woman, barely bigger than Raleigh and me. Her skin always seemed almost ghostly white to us, which I don't believe was a look Charlotte cultivated. But she didn't behave as though she was sickly, and that would obviously become an important issue at the trial. My mother believed there was a critical difference between fragile and sickly. She discouraged many women with histories of medical illness from having their babies at home, but she believed a home birth was an extremely empowering and invigorating experience and gave fragile women energy, confidence, and strength. Charlotte had eyes as gray as moonstone and thin hair the color of straw. She was pretty if you didn't mind the subtle but unmistakable atmosphere of bad luck that seemed to pulse from that pale, pale skin. Raleigh and I spent the 4th of July at the Bedfords, babysitting Fugi. As the Reverend Bedford was paying Raleigh, a fee she would share that day with me, although she was the official Fugi sitter, Mrs. Bedford pulled me into the kitchen. In a voice that was whispery and soft, in a tone that suggested she was discussing a vaguely forbidden subject, she inquired, "Your mother, Connie, is she truly a midwife?" When an airplane crashes, usually far more than one thing has gone wrong. The safety systems on passenger planes overlap, and most of the time it demands a string of blunders and bad luck for a plane to plow into a forest outside of Pittsburgh or skid off a LaGuardia runway into Flushing Bay. I am telling you this because it was the sort of thing my mother's attorney talked about a great deal when he first agreed to defend her. He could go on this way for a long time, always coming to the same point. The shit, so to speak, had to really hit the fan for a plane to auger in. My mother's attorney had been a ground mechanic in the Air Force in the Vietnam War, but had wanted desperately to be a pilot. He loved his airplane analogies. As he sat around our dining room table amidst his piles of yellow legal pads, or as he paced the kitchen, occasionally stopping before the window that faced the ski trails on Mount Chittenden, his point was, it would take the same sort of string of misfortune for one of my mother's patients to die in childbirth as it did for an airplane to crash. And it certainly seemed so, at least initially, in the death of Charlotte Fugit Bedford. She died in the middle of March, after a nightmarishly long labor. The black ice that fell and fell during the night had trapped my mother and her assistant alone with Asa and Charlotte. Even the sand trucks and plows were sliding off the roads. The phones weren't down for particularly long on March 14th, but they were down for just about 4 crucial hours between 12:25 and 4:15 in the morning. And for a time, Charlotte had indeed shown signs that had led my mother to fear a placental abruption, when the placenta detaches itself from the uterine wall so that the mother may slowly bleed to death. There was a moment when Charlotte bled profusely, but the bleeding slowed to a trickle, then stopped. And if there had been an abruption, apparently it had clotted and started to heal itself. And at another point, Charlotte's blood pressure had dropped, falling briefly to 75 over 50, while the baby's heartbeat had slowed to between 60 and 70 beats per minute. My mother and her assistant had only been together 3 months that March, and Anne Austin still had a lot to learn. Clearly, there was chaos in that bedroom well before the worst would occur. Consequently, when Vietnam veteran-turned-Vermont litigator Stephen Hastings first agreed to represent my mother, he concluded that had there not been black ice on the roads, my mother would have driven her patient to the hospital in Newport. Had the phones been working, she would have called the rescue squad, and they might have rushed Charlotte there. And of course, my mother would have done everything possible had Charlotte gone into shock due to a placental abruption. My mother had been prepared to administer oxygen, but Charlotte suddenly stabilized. No, the cause of death had not been placental abruption, as the autopsy would later confirm. And my mother understood this well before the real crisis began. What looked for all the world to her like a ruptured cerebral aneurysm somewhere deep inside Charlotte's brain. Sometimes I would overhear my mother try and explain to Stephen that while there had been moments of turmoil and confusion that night, the chain of events that cost Charlotte Fugit Bedford her life was nothing so complex as the sort of thing that pulled planes from the sky. She would try and tell him it was more cut and dry than all that, and he would gently remind her that it wasn't. Or at least, he would say, it would not be in the eyes of a jury. And then once more they would discuss what had occurred in that bedroom that was indisputable. Charlotte Fugit Bedford went into labor with her second child on Thursday, March 13th, 1981. It was late morning when her contractions began coming in earnest. At 1:40, she phoned my mother. Charlotte's labor had been relatively easy with Fugie, although the first stage, that period when the cervix dilates to 10 centimeters and the contractions become longer, more frequent, and more pronounced, had taken a day and a half in Alabama heat. The second stage, however, had been brief. Once Charlotte was ready to push, she had Fugie through the birth canal in 20 minutes. I remember getting off the school bus in Reddington that afternoon, just as the skies were starting to spit a cold March rain. I was not surprised that my mother was gone when I walked inside our house. I didn't have to read the note she had scribbled to know she was up at the Bedfords. I had been expecting that note for days. At about the same moment that I was returning home from school, one of Asa's parishioners stopped by the Bedford's house and picked up Fugie. The first stage of Charlotte's labor was much longer for the second child than most midwives or doctors would have expected. My mother said she never went into a delivery with any sort of expectations, but when pressed by the state's attorney, she said she might have thought Charlotte's cervix would be fully dilated by 6 or 7 in the evening, and the child pushed into the world by 9 or 10 that night. At the latest. 15 minutes before midnight, when Charlotte was 8 centimeters dilated, my mother carefully ruptured the membranes, damming Charlotte's amniotic waters.
"I don't understand why you did that,"
Anne whispered to my mother, concerned that the intervention had been unnecessary. "It was time," my mother answered with a shrug. At midnight, it started to rain, and the droplets turned to ice when they hit the cold ground. At 12:25, the phones went dead, brought down by the weight of the ice forming on the phone lines and some ill-timed gusts of wind. My mother and her apprentice had no idea the phone lines were down then, but they would discover it soon. Charlotte was fully dilated by 1 a.m. Her first stage had lasted a solid 13 hours. Charlotte's transition, that nightmarish period for many mothers just before they must begin the desperately hard business of pushing, those moments when many mothers fear with a horror that's visceral that they will not survive this ordeal, was rocky. Both my mother and Asa Bedford testified that Charlotte began sobbing through her pain, insisting that this felt different than it had with Fugi. This was killing pain. This was a torture she could not endure and would not survive. And in at least one regard, Charlotte was right when she said it felt different than it had with her first child. Unlike her first delivery, the child's head was pressing against the sacrum, the bone in the rear of her pelvis. Instead of the child facing down as it crowns, it was possible it would emerge sunny side up. But this wasn't alarming my mother. Often, the baby rotates at the end of the first stage of labor or at the beginning of the second. And to increase the chances that the child would spin, and to decrease some of Charlotte's back pain, my mother had Charlotte on her feet and walking around between some of the contractions, and she had her laboring often on her hands and knees. Between 1 and 1:30 in the morning, when Charlotte was most miserable and her sobs were loud and long and filled with despair, Asa prayed, softly at first, his voice even and calm. But as Charlotte's wails grew more plaintive and horrid, his praying grew more animated and intense. Both my mother and Anne testified that he prayed to the Holy Father to help his child Charlotte through this ordeal. Sometimes Charlotte tried saying the Lord's Prayer with him, but she was never able to get through it before she would have to stop to breathe through her pain. And my mother kept trying to reassure them both, and as the night grew long, her own assistant as well, that back labor was hard and painful, but it wasn't fatal. Shortly after 1:30, not long after my mother had asked Asa to climb on the bed and sit behind his wife while she pushed, my mother noticed the blood. She told herself it was mere bloody show, but the timing of the flow and the quantity of the stream made her heart beat in a way that made her nervous. Moreover, Charlotte's suffering seemed extreme, and when my mother took her blood pressure, she saw it had fallen during the hour. The systolic reading had dropped to 80 and the diastolic to 60. Charlotte's pulse was up into the 130s, but the baby's heartbeat was as infrequent as 90 small beats per minute. My mother decided she would not have Charlotte begin to push for another few minutes while she monitored her. If Charlotte's blood pressure continued to fall, if she thought the woman was slipping into shock, or she saw any further signs of fetal distress, she planned to call the town rescue squad and have her taken to the hospital. 3 minutes later, Charlotte's blood pressure had slipped to 75 over 50, and the baby's heartbeat had slowed to 60 or 70 beats per minute. The vaginal bleeding had become a small, almost imperceptible trickle, and then stopped completely. But the wet sheets were a reminder of the size of the earlier wave. And so my mother said to the two parents in the room with her that it would be in both Charlotte's interest and the child's interest to have the baby in a hospital. My mother never came quickly or lightly to the decision that one of her patients should go to a hospital, but she also never hesitated to have a woman in the midst of dangerous complications deliver her baby with modern medicine's extensive safety net unfurled below her. Both she and Asa later testified that had the phones been working that night, things might have ended differently. My mother picked up the phone in the bedroom to dial the rescue squad and discovered there was no purring tone. She suggested that Anne test the phone in the kitchen downstairs. A moment later, Anne called up the stairs. "It's gone, too!" And both my mother and Asa detected panic in the young woman's voice. Rain and hard crystals of ice had been rapping against the bedroom windows for well over an hour now, although my mother said she had only become aware of the sound immediately after Anne yelled the bad news from the foot of the stairs. My mother called Anne back to the bedroom to keep Charlotte and Asa company while she went outside to warm up her car. How slippery had the ground become? My mother fell 4 times, she said, before she crawled on her hands and knees to her automobile. Yet she still planned on driving Charlotte to the hospital and began by attempting to bring the car right up to the front steps of the house. As she pressed her foot down slowly upon the accelerator, the car slid into the remains of an ice-covered snowbank one of Asa's parishioners had built while plowing the driveway throughout the winter. And although my mother's car wasn't damaged, she knew it would be impossible to drive to the hospital. If my mother cried, and it seemed to me that she had every right to as she pushed open the car door and rolled onto the ground to begin her return to the Bedfords' house, she had stopped by the time she rejoined Charlotte and Asa and Anne. But she said later she'd cried. And although my mother feared they would lose the baby, she said it never crossed her mind that Charlotte Fugit Bedford would die. She knew she could stop the bleeding once she had delivered the baby, dead or alive, and surely the phone lines would be quickly fixed. She reminded herself that the woman would have to lose 6 or 7 or even 8 pints of blood before cardiac arrest would occur. And she knew in her birthing bag she had syringes and glass vials of Pitocin and Ergotrate, drugs that caused the uterus to contract hard and could sometimes control internal bleeding. Of course, it was illegal for her to have these regulated substances in her possession, but every midwife carried them. My mother wasn't unique. Nevertheless, the image of Sybil Danforth running around northern Vermont with a big bag full of illegal drugs and syringes wasn't a helpful one in a court of law. Ironically, when my mother returned to the Bedfords' bedroom, Charlotte seemed better. Her blood pressure was returning to normal, as was her baby's heartbeat.
"I believe I'm fine now, Sybil," she said,
the weariness in her voice tinged with hope. In Charlotte's voice, my mother had heard a loving testimony to the power of prayer. As my mother had been slipping so badly outside among the falling drops of cold water and ice that each step since had caused her an excruciating splinter of pain, Asa and Charlotte and even Anne had prayed. Anne said at the trial she had never heard as much love in a man's voice as she did in Asa Bedford's that early morning. My mother was at once comforted and moved. She no longer feared placental abruption. "Well," she said simply, "let's get that little baby out of you." It was, according to the note that she scribbled, 2:03 a.m. My mother sat Charlotte up on the bed between Asa's legs and had her lean against him. My mother did not believe the baby had spun during its descent. Consequently, she anticipated the child would emerge facing the ceiling and the back of its head would continue causing Charlotte pain. For an hour, Charlotte pushed through each contraction, with my mother and Asa and Anne encouraging her to push an extra second or two each time.
"You can do it. A little more, a little more, a little more, a little more.
You're doing fine, just fine, perfect.
Another second, another second, another second."
I saw my mother deliver enough babies to know she was an inspiring coach and a mesmerizingly energetic cheerleader. But who said what between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. would matter greatly to the state, and they insisted, and my mother and her attorney never denied, that Asa and Anne said most of the "you're doing fines," while my mother said most of the "little mores" and "another seconds." After Charlotte had been pushing for almost a full hour, my mother had her rest for 20 minutes. The baby's head, my mother said in court, had made progress during that hour, although the autopsy would be inconclusive. The medical examiner could never be sure how far the baby had descended. At 3:15, Charlotte resumed pushing. She tried, my mother said, as hard as any woman she had ever seen. A few minutes past 4 a.m, my mother had Charlotte rest a second time. My mother insisted that the baby had indeed descended during Charlotte's second effort. Near 4:30, the urge to push became overwhelming, and Charlotte told my mother and her husband that she wanted to try once more, and so she did. For brief seconds at the height of Charlotte's pushing, my mother could see tufts of the child's dark hair, but the baby always seemed to slip back. Did my mother consider giving up and attempting what she knew was probably impossible, navigating the icy roads that separated them from the hospital? My mother said that she did, although she never suggested such a thing to Anne. But even Asa testified that between 5 and 6 o'clock in the morning, my mother limped to the bedroom window and pulled the gauzy drapes away to look outside. "Was that a sand truck I heard?" she asked once in that hour, a remark that her attorney argued was proof she was daydreaming longingly of a cesarean delivery performed by a doctor in Newport. But from the Bedford's bedroom window, the driveway still glistened like glass, and the rain and ice had continued to fall. And Stephen Hastings pointed out, my mother had not actually heard a sand truck. No town trucks had tried venturing onto the roads in or around Lawson between 2:15 and 6:30 in the morning. And even at 6:30, Lawson Road crew member Graham Tuttle would testify, the roads were just plain awful. I drove right on top of the yellow line, sanding and scraping just a single lane. I didn't dare stay on my side of the road.